The following workshop was presented at the 2007 National Conference of the Gospel Coalition.
I need to introduce myself since I am probably not known around here. My day job is senior pastor of Sunset Church in San Francisco that I've been doing for 17 years. And what's important about that place with this seminar is that I have been pursuing to implement the gospel, I guess, wholeness into our church, and it is probably the epicenter of all unusual things that happened in this nation. So I have to put into practice what I know in perhaps the one of the most cutting-edge cities in this nation. My night job is that I teach theology at Western Seminary, and one of my courses is defining and defending the Christian worldview, which a lot of this lecture is based upon. I teach, it takes about probably 24 hours to get through what I'm going to cover in 1 hour. So we're going to go really fast. We're going to deal with beginning with some various worldviews and perspectives on how Christians deal with community and society. We're going to then develop a biblical basis. And then my favorite, one-third of this seminar is actually on application, on exactly what you do, because I find that amongst, let's say, professing evangelicals, there's a great weakness in that, because there's a lot of, what you will understand my terminology, I make a difference between rhetoric and reality. In rhetoric, everyone says, we believe to love thy neighbor, but oftentimes that's rhetoric. What's reality? Reality, they don't do anything. But they cover their backside by saying rhetorically, we believe it and we promote it. And then you raise it, well, who's doing it? And then it's like, well, no one's really doing it. And I find that's a real problem. I find that that is not understanding the gospel in its fullness. So we begin by studying the different views of approaching society. And there's many different categories. For the sake of this seminar, I'm going to give you four pretty much representative views. It's on pages 1 to 2. And we're going to do it by kind of dividing it into sections. People who are, let's say, more to the right. And then say, there's really moderates. They're really moderates. Moderates. And then to the left. To the right, if you're ever going to understand how a believer is to interface with society, you have to deal with the extreme literature. And the extreme literature and the extreme movement is represented by the group known as the Reconstructionist. Okay? They are all Reformed people. All of them are post-millennial, but not all Reformed people are Reconstructionists. Actually, only a small minority of Reformed people are Reconstructionists, but all Reconstructionists are Reformed. And the reason is that if there's one word that summarizes what they hold is the three-letter word law, the law. And what makes them different than the usual Reformed person, there is no Reconstructionist in the Gospel Coalition. And the reason why is they take an extreme interpretation of the law that says both moral and civil aspects of the Old Testament law are still need to be in all civil governments of this world, and we need to promote it. So the usual Reformed person says, oh, it's the moral law. So civil law about tassels on your underwear and stuff like that, you know, we don't really need that. The Reconstructionists would say, no, no, no. It's civil law, even the penal law. So they would say things like, oh, we should still kill people for adultery, execute them for homosexuality. It was even a comment, oh, would you still use stoning? Because that's in the law. And they would say, well, it is a cost-effective means of execution. Now, you could say, well, it's what is that, a humor? No, it's not really humor because of how they think about the law. They are so tight in their system that they make no differentiation between the moral and civil. So then you understand why they are into that. Because of their presupposition and theological position, by necessity, their emphasis is going to be on legislation in government, given the fact that that is the emphasis of their movement. And that's what Reconstructionists are big in. We want to bring in not only moral, but civil law back into the United States. And even though they believe, you know, you need to be converted first in the spiritual revival, this is basically the emphasis. Okay, I went through like an hour in 5 minutes, okay? But I hope you get an understanding of this. You could read a lot more stuff, but without this, you're not going to know where a lot of the trends come. Now, this next group, I define, and I coined this phrase up myself, legislative moralists. Now, the legislative moralist is someone what we consider the religious right. They may include the Reconstructionists, but they are not Reconstructionists because the legislative right, most of them don't hold to Reconstructionist theory. That's really interesting. So you would have, and it's good, it's off, people like, you know, Jerry Falwell, you know, he passed away, he'd fit in this. Pat Robertson, he'd fit in this. They are not Reconstructionists. Pat Robertson is not Reformed. Jerry Falwell is not Reformed. You ask Jerry Falwell, should we kill homosexuals? Jerry Falwell says no, because he is not into the porting over of civil law. But many of the moral issues, they carry over, and they are influenced by reading. You'll find out that these people, they don't really have a clear theology. What are you basing it on? We don't really know. But they're reading stuff from all areas, and they're sort of like, it's sort of a hybrid of we don't really know. And one of the basis is that it's a reactionary group to what they feel is the general moral decay in America that has occurred with the exclusion of school prayer, the possibility of recognizing homosexual marriages, ACLU, that type of thing. It's reactionary. And because it's reactionary, it's sort of like, let's round the, those wagons. Let's circle the wagons, hold down the fort. Let's get anyone who holds anything close to our view, because we need to defend ourselves. Because of that, it's not theologically keen. You look for Jerry Falwell's system, and you really can't find it. It's not as tight as the Reconstructionist whatsoever, but it's there. It is reactionary. And the key to this group is that they hold to various key moral issues that they see in a watershed let's say moral issues. I'm using the same term because of that, the nation is falling apart. They're reactionary, key moral issues. They also hold that because they are the key moral issues, we cannot waste our time on any of the other moral issues. Let me give you an example. There's a great debate over the inclusion of global warming amongst the evangelical platform. About a year ago, a group of high-powered evangelicals, what included Rick Warren, had a letter drafted to the National Association of Evangelical asking for global warming to be put in the NAE platform. About two dozen of the right-winged NAE wrote a letter saying, no, you won't, basically because it takes away the unifying energy upon the key moral issues of our day, which is homosexuality and abortion. On top of this, the legislative moralist is usually defined by an unusual understanding of America being a Christian nation. It was founded by Christians. It's we're under God. You know, instead of believing it's a generic God that is not named, they'll say that Christianity had special privileges. And so if there's any attempt to remove God, they really get really very defensive, and they'll say, yeah, we've always been Christian. So there's a nationalism. Now, in my course, we deal with each one of these things to knock down the nationalism thing. But by how you define and see these legislative moralists, you can tell how they're going to emphasize work in society. It's going to be on these key issues. It's not that we don't love our neighbors. It's not that we don't like helping the poor, but it takes away our energy from this. And what we need is to get people in office who will turn back Roe v. Wade. By hook or by crook, we will overturn it. Now, they won't say it as blatantly as I did, but in reading how they respond, you see, because rhetorically, everyone on this group would say, oh, we believe in helping society. We believe in well-living our neighbor. But in terms of reality, no. In terms of what they actually do, it's just rhetoric that they are actually helping their neighbor. Realistically, they're honing in on these two issues. And everything is just sort of, look, you can't do everything. So we're gonna patch up the major hole. Okay? Now, I spent another 5 minutes. This takes an hour or two in my class to talk about this. We now move to the moderates. And the moderates, there's an intriguing view developed by Abraham Kuyper from the Dutch Reform School. Great, great guy, educator, like theologian. He was prime minister of the Netherlands. This guy did everything, He did everything. And Kuyper's view is different than this group because this group focuses on the moral and civil law. It's a very tight system, but it's wrong, This group has no real system, but it's trying to do its best, okay? This group actually does have a system, and it's called the cultural mandatist. You can read a little about it in my paper. The key to the cultural mandatist is the interpretation of Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. I'm going to read that verse for you because I'm allowed another 5 minutes on this subject. It says, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and every living creature that moves on the ground." Now they take that and they say, aha, it's the cultural mandate. This verse, Genesis 1:28, tells us that the follower of God needs to go through every part of society and influence that part of society. Kuyper tried to live it out by he was a publisher, he was a politician, he was a theologian, so he lived out these principles. A modern proponent of the cultural mandatist is Charles Colson. Now, I read a book, How Now Shall We Live, which is a great book. I really like the book. But I want to tell you that the thing that I really didn't like about Colson, and I know they don't like naming names in this group, in this coalition, but this is only a sub-seminar, so I'll name the name. They'll have a black line through it when it's on the web. If you do it to page 2, this is what Colson writes. "The same command is binding on us today, the Cultural Commission. Though the fall introduced sin and evil into human society, it did not erase the cultural mandate. The generations since Adam and Eve still bear children, build families, spread across the earth. They still tend animals and plant fields. They still make music and works of art. It is our contention in this book that the Lord's cultural commission is inseparable from the Great Commission." Now, you see, I love Colson's application. If you ever read the book, I love his application, Going into Society, but I think it's a bit of an overstatement to say that the Cultural Commission is equal to the Great Commission, because I read Genesis 1:28 and I'm scratching my head and I says, I don't really see it. I don't really see it there. Even in the book of Genesis, the Cultural Commission was not a major verse in which the whole book developed. The book of Genesis isn't about Abraham taking his faith and going into Mesopotamian culture and changing it. The book of Genesis is about Abraham leaving known civilization, going into the wild land, into Canaan, into a land that God would bring him. It's total opposite. So to say that the Cultural Commission is more important, is most important, and is clear, I say it's not even clear in the book of Genesis. You're taking the whole thing out of context. So God bless the cultural mandatists. I love Charles Colson and his application. I love what these guys are trying to do. I'm just saying, don't use Genesis 1:28 as your basis, theological basis, because it's not there. Just not there. There needs to be something else that is gospel-centered. Because even Colson would say, and I didn't put this in the paper, he'd say, well, I'll admit there's nothing in the New Testament about this. And then I'm saying, well, if you admit there's nothing in the New Testament about this, why are you making it is at the center of your theology? Okay? It's just a little pet peeve I have that if you are going to have a system in which Christians are to interact with society, it better be truly biblical and reflect the true emphasis that is found in the Gospels rather than proof texting something that when you look at it doesn't even teach it. Who needs that? Now you got the left, and there's a whole bunch of people. I enjoy reading people on the left. Probably the most famous is Jim Wallis of Sojourners, God's Politics. Tony Campolo would be someone that fits in this realm. And a key to the left group, which I would define, let's take away the left, I would call them redemptive moralists. Is that they are on the other side of the legislative moralist. The redemptive moralist sees all issues relatively equal. The legislative moralist says, oh, it's only two main things. So let's put all our eggs in these litmus test baskets. So what are you? What's your view on abortion? Oh, sorry, we can't vote for you, you know? The redemptive moralist, you could tell a redemptive moralist because they'll say, well, you know, these things are wrong, but there are other things that are wrong too. Social injustice. The cycle of poverty in the inner city. They'll say, you need to deal with issues of poverty, genocide, global warming, on top of homosexuality and abortion. So these people want a wider platform. Now, I really like this group because I love interaction in gracious manner, as you will see as this seminar unfolds. The problem I have with the redemptive moralist is they're quite loose with Scripture. Wow. If you ever read Jim Wallis or Tony Campolo, I really ask you to actually read the verses that they are citing as evidence. It's like, okay. I remember reading Tony Campolo Speaking My Mind. I like his book. I like people who are controversial. And he'll say, you know, Christians, I can't see how Christians, you know, volunteer soldiers, we need to be pacifists because God says, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall inherit the earth. So I'm reading, and I says, you know, first there's a problem to take a Christian ethic like that and to put it in government ethic. Because I said to myself, how about the other 99% of the Sermon on the Mount? How come Tony's not asking for those things? Maybe we should start persecuting people because the Sermon on the Mount also says, blessed are the persecuted. Maybe we should have a sort of a laws on limiting free speech because it's anyone who says fool or stupid is liable for hell's fire. So let's have laws on that too, you know? And oh yeah, well, let's have, instead of laws against adultery and that and homosexuality, let's have laws against lust. Anyone lost, we'll have Saul chopping off people's hands because it says that in the Sermon on the Mount. See, the Sermon on the Mount is very radical. But if you take a verse, then you better be careful what you take and be consistent with your understanding on the Sermon on the Mount because it's understood on many, many different levels. Another example is Jim Wallace. He gave a suggestion to that the Western nations should forgive the debt of developing third world countries. Now, I have no problem with that. I mean, that'd be really good. It's good to forgive debt if you have the ability, and you know, and it doesn't really affect you that much. You know, America has a lot of money. The Western world has a lot of money. The problem is that to base that, Jim Wallace cites the Old Testament law of Jubilee, which is the return of the land every 50 years. Now, if you don't know if you understand the law, but the Year of Jubilee was written to show that God owns the land. That you think you own the land, but you don't own the land. God owns the land. It's theological. It's very, very theological, the reason behind it. So it was not, you know, I see it, it's not just a socialistic law to even the playing field every 50 years, which may, that may be a secondary application to it. But the primary application is that it was to remind Israel that this is God's land that he basically leased out to the Israelites, leased out. After 50 years, lease ends, we got to write it all over again. Now, you see, you take proof texting, and then it's like, well, you know, it's not really what it says, not really what it says, and it's not that I'm opposed to the application of it, but I really believe that if we are to present the gospel and to promote the gospel in its fullness of truth, we need to have a system that clearly manifests the true emphasis in the Gospels, rather than taking out some unusual system of Old Testament law, a mishmash of I don't know what to defend certain select principles, to find Genesis 1:28 as the key to understanding all our interaction in this world, or to start pulling proof texts from I don't know where just to support what you want to do. Basically, this is what is out there in the main categories, be it Wallace, Campolo, be it Colson, be it Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, be it the Reconstructionist. It is my hope that the Gospel Coalition develops a theology of social interaction that is entirely biblically based and manifests in total graciousness. Now, how do you do that? Since these I have found wanting. Forgive me if I touched on one of your favorite guys. But I'm pretty passionate about the weaknesses in them. In terms of understanding the biblical basis, I use a few parameters that I tell my students that first, any theological system cannot have the feeling that it is being forced upon the teaching of Christ in the New Testament, like the Reconstructionists or the Cultural Mandatists. It should feel like Jesus said it. If you have to force it, if you have to say, oh, the key is in this obscure verse in Joel, you know, and then it's like, hey, man, it's not even the New Testament. No, but if you understand it's in the obscure passage in Joel, you know, unlocks everything. Oh, that's hooey, you know. It's like, what is that? If Jesus didn't say it clearly, why do you need some obscure passage in the Old Testament to defend it? It needs to be in the New Testament, in the teaching of Christ, and it's the best if Christ actually said it himself. Because then there's no debate. Now, in the Gospel Coalition, we define the gospel in its entirety. I don't know if you caught it. It's different from the old, let's say, fundamentalist understanding that the gospel are the three things or four things you know to get you saved, and then everything else is not really the gospel. We don't know what it is, but we know what the gospel is. It is those four things that you need to become Christians. The Gospel Coalition believes in a larger understanding of the gospel. As Don Carson began by saying, it is the gospel according to Matthew, the whole thing. The gospel according to John, it's the whole thing. Now, within this whole thing, though, there are key statements of Jesus Christ defining social interaction and what he is really, things that summarize his general teaching. And I base my understanding of social interaction upon that famous passage in when it was asked of Jesus, who is my neighbor, in Matthew chapter 22, verses 34 on. Now, I'm not going to read it because of time, and I'm going to spend the next 15 minutes explaining this, next 15 minutes applying this, and the last 15 minutes fielding questions. So I got everything done. It has intrigued me when this question was posed of Jesus, because the Pharisee, expert in the law, asked Jesus, what is the greatest commandment? Jesus gives two answers. Why does Jesus give two answers when only one is asked? And it is my contention that two answers are given by Jesus because Jesus understands that, one, that faith without a gracious interaction is dead. I'm going to read it right from my notes. Second, that the minority teaching in the law does not support the second greatest commandment. And the third, in order to support his contention that loving thy neighbor is a majority teaching in the Old Testament, he has to include the law, which he skillfully does, because at the end of the dialogue, even though the Pharisee asks which is the greatest commandment, which puts the issue under the law, at the end, Jesus brings in the prophets by saying, upon these two commandments, all the law and the prophets hang. Jesus is very skillful. Pharisee wants the law. Jesus gives it to him. But in order to fully support what he's going to teach, he brings in at the back end the prophetic teaching. Oh, so skillful. Wow. This was really good. And I probably thought the Pharisee didn't even know what hit him either. Jesus just put it in the back there. What's in the law? The first and greatest commandment, to love your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. There is no debate that this is the greatest commandment. Jesus said it. Also, when you study the role of Deuteronomy 6 in synagogue worship and in temple worship, you will see that the Shema, which Deuteronomy 6 is a part of, was recited every day in the temple service. You will also know that the Shema is basically the foundational element that undergirds Israel's monotheism. Hear, O Israel, our God is one. Non-controversial. Bingo, you hit the nail on the head, Jesus. Everyone, every religious Jew knows this. We recite it at the temple all the time. It's the basis of our monotheism. We're not going to spend our time talking about the Shema. We're going to talk about the need for Jesus to include the second greatest commandment, which is totally, it wasn't asked. And the reason is, in my mind, because Jesus understood that if you only obey the first commandment, that is great, without understanding what it needs to do to you, it is an incomplete understanding. Because, as the Gospel Coalition is trying to present, and hopefully more and more in the future it will do it, just the cognitive understanding of who God is was never enough in the Old Testament, was not taught by Jesus or Paul in the New Testament, and it is never what defined a follower of God. In adding the second greatest commandment, Jesus was saying that it is beyond the cognitive and there's actually a practical. Yet, no doubt that there is the greatest commandment, to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. But there's something else. And when you want to see those two things, you could see the whole teaching ministry and the actual life ministry unfold under these two great commandments. I tell people, You read the red letter edition of the New Testament, and the red letters, what Jesus says, he's like toughest talking Messiah ever. Hey, man, what are you doing here? Let the dead bury the dead, man. You got some of you guys at laptops? You know, leave everything. Follow me. You know, he is really tough talking, you know. Incredibly high level of discipleship. Why? Because Jesus believes to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul is number one. And all of Jesus' teaching falls underneath that. His red letters. It's all about high level of commitment because Jesus knows Deuteronomy 6:5 is it. Now, but when you read the black letters, you get a whole different Jesus. It's almost as he has dual personality. You get the black letters, Jesus is healing everybody, going into the towns. He's like sleepless. The only time he gets to pray is like at midnight in some mountain. You know, people are cutting holes in roofs, lowering people to him. They're touching him while he's walking, you know. He's got groupies falling all around, and he doesn't mind it. He cries for the masses. Now, this is really interesting. You got this tough-talking Messiah. Leave everything, follow. Let the dead bury the dead. Whoever wants to be first must be last. You know, and then he proves it by dying for us, you know. I mean, and that's I jumped ahead. That's the second part. He talks tough. The second thing is that he's just gracious, and he proves it by dying for us. To understand the ministry of Jesus Christ in its fullness in the Gospels must include both elements in Christian churches and amongst believers today. This ability to proclaim the truth with graciousness, but with extreme clarity. Just say it. Just say it. But to live your life with endless, excessive graciousness. I mean, that, to me, that reflects who I read when I read Jesus. For people who say, well, Jesus doesn't talk tough. I say, I don't know what you're talking about. The verses that are most convicting when I read them are the red letters about how tough he is and what I need to be. And then, but about his graciousness, about helping everybody, feeding 5,000, you know, people, even like people who are poor, who are sick, you know, and you'll eat with sinners. You know, I don't know what Bible you're reading, but I see that merciful Jesus all the other times that I'm not greatly convicted about what I need to be. I'm greatly convicted now about how I need to relate to people's needs, you know. Both exist. Without the other, you have an incomplete Jesus. Imagine if you have a tough-talking Jesus and he doesn't do any healing, he doesn't help anybody. He becomes John the Baptist. What do you want to be John the Baptist for? Or you deny any of the tough-talking parts of Jesus and you just do good. No, that's not Jesus either. It's both. It's in Matthew 22, to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And the second greatest commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself. One of the things that Jesus understood is the connection of the two. It is not only found in the teaching and life of Jesus, it is found in the great passage in James 2, which is often the basis of lordship and grace. How much do you need to do after you confess a belief in God, you know? Is it good enough just to say you believe in God, you know? And James says, well, you know, Satan believes, you know, God is present, but, you know, in fear and trembling, but he's not saved. And he talks about how you need to actually express it. But let me draw your attention that James chapter 2, the whole discussion on the relationship between faith and works was introduced by the problem in the early church of believers treating the poor with a sort of a disdain. It's the whole context of James 2. How can you say when a poor person comes in, you sit there? How can you say be blessed? And if you don't take care of his physical needs, will that save him? That is the whole context of that famous theological debate of the understanding faith without works is dead. We talk about, you know, whether, you know, you're a free grace person or lordship's person. You know, I'll tell you, you talk about in that theological plan, you miss the whole point. It's about if you say you have faith, how come you are not treating the poor with dignity? It's not just theological concepts of lordship, Calvinism. Because you could have a Calvinist who would say faith without works is dead. doesn't take care of the poor, mistreats them, isolates, that person doesn't know what his theology is trying to teach him. I get really heated on this because all you do is you read the context and it's there. That's what James 2 is all about. Just read it. It's all about the treatment of the poor. That's the connection of faith. Now, I don't have more time. I really, see, my day job is I'm a pastor. My night job is I'm a professor. But my day part of me gets in my night part of me. So oftentimes when I lecture, I get like this, all excited, because I'm really excited about theology. Okay, so Jesus understands you need to bring in the two. He brings in Luke 19, and he understands that Luke 19 is present in the law to love thy neighbor, but when you study the breakdown of Old Testament law, you will see and you will have to admit that Old Testament law, when it came to commandments, mitzvot of graciousness, of compassion, were a minority. Sorry, it's the way it is. I just want to be honest. It was a minority teaching. I just give you 2 minutes of sort of an illustration of this. One of the famous rabbis of all times by the name of Maimonides, great medieval rabbi, he was the first one who counted that there are 613 mitzvot. 613 commandments in Old Testament law, minus ceremonial, the feast days, the sacrifice laws. 613. You could find these in Wikipedia. It's all over the place, okay? So you find it, you could have print it out. Maimonides said, what's very interesting is that of these 613, 365 are negative. Easy, one for every day of the year. God's a supernatural God, you know, one for every day of the year. Most of them were negative. Not only that, when you counted Maimonides' list, about 5% were merciful. That's it. And they were basically in the gleaning laws. Leave some fruit on the trees. If you leave your bag there, just leave it for the poor. Have the special tithe for the poor, you know, leave it for the alien, for the orphan, for the widow. You want to do word study? It's the hat trick. It's either the orphan, the widow, or the alien. And if you find these verses on mercy, but in the law, they were the minority teaching. No more than about 5%. That's why Jesus has to bring in the prophets, because the law by itself cannot support Jesus' full contention. It can support that it's present in the law, but it cannot prove that it is the second most important. In order to prove that it's the second most important, Jesus has to bring in the prophets, which he does, because at the end he says, upon these two commandments, all the law and the prophets hang. Jesus brings in the prophets, and when you study the prophets, you will see that issues of law and the breaking of the law now include the major theme of social injustice and the failure to care for the poor. Major themes. And I'm not going to bring proof text. I hate proof texting. You're in my class, you proof text, you know, you get a C, you know? What you want to do is bring in major passages that teach this. You proof text anything, you know, whatever you want. You know, you could proof text that. I won't say that, but you could proof text anything, okay? The passages I bring, Amos, especially in the minor prophets. You know, the book of Amos, chapters 1 and 2, begins with the condemnation of the civilizations around Israel. And the prophet brings in the reasons for their condemnation. Then we get to Amos chapter 2, verses 4 to 8, and listen to the condemnation that God gives to Judah and Israel. This is what the Lord says, for three sins of Judah, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath because they have rejected the law of the Lord and have not kept my decrees because they have led astray by false gods. And their gods, their ancestors, follow. I will send fire upon Judah that will consume the fortresses of Jerusalem. This is what the Lord says, for three sins of Israel, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. They sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample on the heads of the poor as upon the dust of the ground. They deny the justice to the oppressed. Father and son use the same girl and so profane my holy name. They lie down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge. In the house of their God, they drink wine taken as fines. Now, what's interesting is in the condemnation in Amos, which is the basis for the judgment in the book of Amos, two themes comes out. You're being judged for one, you've been led astray by false gods, you do not love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind, and you do not love your neighbor. You trample upon the heads of the poor. It's in the minor prophets. Now, I don't have time. You read Hosea, you read Zechariah, major portions of scripture. You don't like take a little verse here and, you know, and that's it. No, that doesn't prove anything. You could take a little verse and, you know, prove you know, whatever you want. You want major portions of scripture from the prophets. And when you see the prophetic condemnation, the mistreatment of the poor goes up right to the top. It is the top two. They have left their true God to worship false gods. And you have mistreated the people. It's in the prophets. What was minor in the law, Jesus reapportions through the prophets and raises it straight from the top. In this way, that is why Jesus can say, upon these two commandments, all the teaching of the law and the prophets hang. Jesus' teaching is a continuation of the law and of the prophets. It's continuation. It is not something really new. What Jesus does is he focuses keenly, because in the prophets and in the law, it is never specifically stated which are the two most important ones that we should obey. And Jesus does it in a masterfully skillful way that helps you understand the law and helps you understand the prophets. Through this, we then have teaching about Jesus expanding the understanding of who the neighbor is through the Good Samaritan. And I love this. The hero is a Samaritan who is basically a heretic. And the villains are Jews, a priest, you know, they go on the side. And the story is this. It's not only an extension of the manifestation of love to outside of those community. That's actually not the major teaching. The major teaching was this, that the heretic is actually closer to the ideal of God than those who know theologically the concept of God. That those who know the concept of God, a la the priests, were shamed by the heretic in the Good Samaritan. It's extremely interesting. The Orthodox is shamed by the heretic. Wow. That tells you how much Jesus brought up this understanding of actually living out your love for your neighbor. Because if you don't, your orthodoxy, in a sense, you're like those guys. You see? Now, I'm not saying that the heretic is saved. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying there's a real problem when the Orthodox do not express their love and compassion to those in need around them. You know, I could get in all sorts of things. I'm not a religious right person, though. I'm against abortion. Sometimes well-meaning believers say we need to go back to the glory days, when we had school prayer and stuff like that. And nothing wrong with school prayer. I like school prayer. Those are the glory days. We need to return the country back to God back then. I'd say, you know, I'm a minority. There's a few minorities here. You know, for 200 years, African Americans have been treated really with a lot of disrespect. They came here because of slavery, emancipated under Jim Crow law. It took people who were not Orthodox Christians to give liberty and true freedom to minorities. Where was the Orthodox Christian? They had a chance for 200 years. Where were they? It took humanists, as great, I'm ashamed of Orthodox Christianity. You had 200 years to do it. And you use verses to justify bigotry. If you study the exegesis of those times used by Christians to justify prejudice. The Chinese emancipation, the Exclusion Act of 1882. The Chinese men came in the thousands to build the railroads, and we were welcomed by the Exclusion Act, which basically says you can't bring any Chinese women into the country, so you either leave the country or you live the rest of your life single. Magnuson Act of 1943, great generous kind act to allow a whopping and generous 105 Chinese immigrants in the United States. I feel so gracious. Those were the glory days, weren't they? You know, sure, there are problems today, but there are problems back then. Don't tell me this glory stuff. You know, I really heated on this because I really believe, you see, I'm not proof texting anything. I'm bringing your, what Jesus is, what he said was most important. That's what the gospel is. I'm not pulling any rabbits out of anyone's hat, you know? And this is the strength of how I perceive it and the weaknesses of these different positions, that if you really understood the gospel teaching and it's based upon cognitive understanding of the correct God, to love him with everything of your being, it has to translate into overt and observable gracious acts to people in need that are other than yourself. Just has to be. Because you don't understand the gospel. But. And you have lots of people who will agree with what I say, but in reality, do nothing. And I got a real problem with that. Because you will have people across every line that says, I have no problem with Jeff's teaching. My problem is, what are you doing? What are you doing? You see? Now we get into the final 15 minutes of what we do. And then I'll leave it for questions. I get really heated. You could see how I could... My students, I teach four-hour lectures, and I'm on this for 4 hours. I'm on. It's on and on and stuff. I always believe that, as a pastor, I have to apply the things that I know. That's what I'm bound to do. It's not I teach you guys one thing, and then I lead my church in a total bizarre way, another way. I mean, who needs that? It's all hypocrisy. So I've moved my church into what I consider gospel centeredness. I tell you about my church. I had all the things that were obstacles to this, and that I pastor in the city of San Francisco, where there's a great deal of family flight out of the city. I pastor a bilingual Chinese church, and I don't know if you guys are in no ethnic ministries. It's basically isolationist. By the fact of how it began. And a lot of things going against me. A lot of good things going against me. You know, we're a fundy background church. I wasn't a church plant. I was there, was 10 years founded. Before I was there, was fighting church, was declining. At everything that's going to be like dead, you know. I've been there 17 years, and we've gone through way ups and downs. But I've been moving it to gospel-centeredness. And I use what I have in my control, which is the pulpit, to guide them, not to proclaim hermeneutical theological nuggets, which I went to Dallas Theological Seminary. That's how they trained me to preach. Theological, ooh, we never saw that. Wow, I didn't see that connection, you know. Wow. No. The purpose of preaching is to lead your people in where they need to go. And so I have the pulpit. This is what I believe. This is what I teach. I taught on prayer for 6 months straight until they got sick of that topic, because I want to make the people of my church a people of prayer. I control the pulpit. You're tired of listening. I don't care. You guys are going to be people of prayer, and I'm going to preach it for 6 months until we come in. Now we do a lot of prayer. Well, in terms of interaction, I have the obstacles of the culture of the city. Well, if you read the list of things we do, it's sort of like it's incredible what we've done this past year. Page 10. This almost led entirely by laymen. We sent out four teams to Katrina stricken in New Orleans to help rebuild that area. We'll send finally seven teams, I think, by year's end. Seven teams. We got about 1,000 people, less than 1,000 adults. Seven teams, we get involved in Habitat for Humanity in San Francisco every month. We made up 20% of the attendees at the International Justice Mission. Any guys know of IJM? They help free children caught in slavery in Southeast Asia, Christian organization. Well, they were coming into San Francisco, and the fear was, look, we can't get any evangelical support in San Francisco. It's the first time they're going to have it. So they did it anyway. We made up 20% of the tables, over 100 people, at $100 a person. We made up 20%. We have neighborhood groups meeting our place for free. We have ongoing homeless ministry. We are the collection center for Operation Christmas Child with Franklin Graham. We do SF Connect, which is we tie in with the homeless ministry in San Francisco. Some people tutor at-risk kids. Now, I tell people, look, this is not the end of what we do. If you think you just do good and that's all you do, then you don't understand the completeness of the gospel. They really don't need what we do. What they really need is Christ. This allows us to manifest the graciousness of Christ so that some will look at, as Tim Keller said, based upon his message on 1 Peter, one, people will hate you and love you at the same time. How does that happen? They hate you for some of the things you say. They'll love you for the things that you do. Your church and your Christian life has to be marked by that dilemma. They'll love you and hate you at the same time. How does your community love you and hate you at the same time? It's a great test, isn't it? Because if they love you, I could guarantee you're not proclaiming something. If all they do is love you, you're not proclaiming something. If all they do is hate you, you don't show any graciousness, really, to the community. And to me, it's not an option. They both have to be present in the ministry of the local church and the life believer, because Jesus Christ himself, either verbally saying it or through his example in which he lived, manifested it. It's a no-brainer to me. It's a no-brainer. And, I tell people, well, you can't do everything in your church, but I think your church should do something. What is it doing? And I have these tests, too, on how you could show whether your church is doing something. It's on page 8. It seeks to be positive, interactive, and helpful to the real needs in community. Some people would say, oh, we're getting people to vote for Republican candidates. Isn't that social interaction? I said, it's so imperfect. We already dealt. You got to go through the whole lecture to understand that. That's not it. I don't see Jesus telling his people to do that. It's actually helping people on demand as they see the need right there. I have no problem, and I'll tell you, when it comes to really, well, I go really fast, too. The ministries of gracious compassion and communities are substantial. It's not like three people meeting in the basement of a church on Tuesday night, while your church is 5,000 and you got five people of the faithful meeting in some room. That's not it either, because that's just tokenism, not really part of the church. It's really, we have that ministry to appease the radicals. if that ministry ends, doesn't really affect the church. It's just appeasement. That is not living out the gospel, because the gospel has loving thy neighbor as number two. If you can have a church building program before loving your neighbor, there's something wrong with your priority. Now you're really heated on this, you know. Something wrong with your priority. And workers are to be voluntary, and service should be free. I'm really big for that. Okay, you could be nominal, but it's nominal. I don't like these things. I'm not opposed to for Christian schools, but I don't think having Christian schools where you charge someone $20,000 for tuition to pay teachers $50,000 and say that's community service. No. God bless Christian schools, Christian preschools. God bless them. May we have more of them. But that is not compassion-based ministry. That is a fee-based service. We different if you had a school and you like charge the students $100 a year. You raise all the funds for the team. That's totally different. To poor people, that's totally different, you see. But who does that, you know? Well, very few people do that. But you see the difference? Because sometimes people use the rhetorical to defend their inability to actually live out the true compassion of Jesus Christ. And I want you students to be aware of that and not to be tricked by it. It's really important that as we as believers grow, that we do this. There's a real important passage I have on the role in government. And I don't have time, but I delve with that really tricky issue of the role in government of the believer. And I think you'll enjoy my thoughts on it, but we don't have time. I want to end, because I want time for questions, with my favorite Christian of all ages. And you will never hear his name mentioned at the Gospel Coalition. One, because he's not Reformed. He was a early dispensationalist, which is my background, which is, you never want to say that in this group, in Reformed people. This guy was an early follower of J.N. Darby, the father of all dispensational movements. He was a nobleman. He believed in the inerrancy of the word and a literal interpretation. Let me tell you about Lord Shaftesbury. He lived in the 19th century. Most people remember William Wilberforce. But Lord Shaftesbury, what he did as a member of parliament and later outside, but using his influence, one, changed child labor laws so kids like 5 years old wouldn't work in coal mines. He ended chimney sweep laws that had little kids stuck in chimneys and like burned alive. He reformed lunacy laws and made lunacy asylums more humane. He reformed the hospital system. He had a system of no interest loans to poor women so that they could develop small businesses. They just pay it back without interest so that they could do others. His greatest thing was his ragged school ministry, because when he lived, 12 out of 13 kids in England never went to school. And this guy said something's wrong because it was an elitist thing. They developed a ragged school system. Over 200,000, I've read, were educated through a system of schools. Now, who's this guy? The guy would be considered kind of fundamentalist these days. But let me just read you the final paragraph, then we'll have questions. End of 16. Shaftesbury lived by a religion that gave him his sustaining force. Shaftesbury's philanthropy was marked by the same personal devotion, the difference between him and each evangelicals, and such evangelicals as Hannah Moore, was like the difference between a hero and villain in one of Dickens' novels. Hannah Moore reminded the starving laborers that they could have as much of the gospel as a light for nothing. Shaftesbury never looked on the distress in this spirit, and he never thought that the rich had fulfilled their duties to the poor when they had given them a cheap copy of the Bible and a few improving tracts. He set to work out to try to put destitute men and women on their feet, for there was about his religion something that distinguished it from the religion of most of the people who shared his theological views. If you watched his mind at work, you would conclude that he was as narrow as Mr. Edmund Gosse's father or one of Mark Rutherford's Bibles. If you noted his objects of his compassion, you would conclude that he was as liberal-minded as a man as Cordesett or Godwin or Lodwitt or any other of the humanitarians whose doctrines he dreaded. He never gave up the hope for the smaller. Like many good men, he could live up to his creed without living down to it. When Shaftesbury died, over 100,000 of London's poor came out in the rain with signs that said, "I was hungry and you fed me. I was naked and you clothed me." This guy was a solid evangelical, more fundamentalist than probably everyone in this room. But all of us put together don't even come close to the compassion and grace of Shaftesbury. It is this balance of truth that, if you understand it correctly, fuels the compassion and love, so that you don't have to use some suspicious theological system. It is solely grounded upon the word and teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ. I am sold out on this. I am totally, I cannot believe a church could operate without understanding this. It is so elementary in my understanding now. When you study the scriptures, study the law, study the prophets, study the very words of Christ, and not to just hold it rhetorically, but to actually live it in life. I did it. Can't believe I did it. I did about 20 hours of lectures in about an hour and 5 minutes. Yeah, there's time for 10 minutes of questions, and that'll be it. Yes?
I think it was Mark Noll one time who said that in his observation of the history of Christian art, those who made the most significant art were those that had the deepest or most profound understanding of the sacraments. It seems to me, in thinking about these things, that it's those Christians who have the deepest and most profound understanding of the gospel that are ultimately the ones who do and live out mercy and ultimately justice most significantly. And I think Matthew 18 goes to your point, you know, that the tale of the unmerciful servant is that ultimately we ought to be able to
help people. Yes. That the unmerciful servant, I have it in there, but it's really interesting. All that is this expression of grace is only done when you comprehend the full graciousness that we have received, that I think Tim Keller referred to, you referred to, the parable of the unmerciful servant. You will see that there are a few unusual conditions that Jesus speaks about. In the Sermon on the Mount, after he gives the Lord's Prayer, at the end he says, "And if you don't forgive others, the Heavenly Father won't forgive you." I said, "What is that?" I said, "Oh, that sounds kind of weird. Doesn't it feel like it falls under grace?" But it does, because it's the relationship that if you can't be gracious to someone else, how can you ever say you understand grace? It's those who profoundly understand grace that can live it. Very much true.
Yeah.
Seven times 70. Yeah, it's the ability to continue to do it, to have a ministry and attitude of servanthood, even if they don't like what you say. You see, sometimes you say, "Oh, we'll only do it if they like what we say." Well, that's not really what Christ's teaching is. Yes?
I pastor a church plant down in Springfield, Illinois.
Yeah.
Speak
yeah,
against them?
Yeah.
Where's that balance?
Oh, the question was, what about the issues that obviously there are the need to show graciousness to people, but what about the key legislative issues that, let's say, like abortion and things like that? Well, I don't have the time in my lecture. It's in my notes here. But let me tell you that I am pro-life. I led a steering committee in responding to Gavin Newsom's declaration in San Francisco to allow marriages of like gender. And so I have this uniqueness where I can show acts of graciousness, but I also can be kind of like a political activist, I guess, also on certain issues. I will say that when I've done that, you do it with as much grace. And I fought fundamentalists who wanted to use a lot of hate language. But I also know the growing non-response of younger evangelicals who didn't want to publicly say anything. And I said, this is like the most important issue that will determine like human society. I'm in America for a long time, and you're sitting out on this one. If you sit on this one, you're basically saying you're going to sit out on every single one. So there are issues that I find more very important. I find abortion is the greatest blight in this world. And I think young evangelicals don't like to talk about it because it's yesterday's subject. So we like to talk about Darfur and Genesis, hunger, poverty. I'll tell you how we do it in my church. 3 weeks ago, we had a time of prayer, 20 minutes of prayer in our service. And we prayed for, at the beginning, IJM, children stuck in prostitution, raising of local Christians to change government law in the countries they're in, because that's really how it's going to change, by the governments putting pressure on these brothels with children, Then we prayed for Darfur, the genocide. Then we prayed for every person killed in the Virginia Tech massacre. We had pictures and names and description. And then I ended with my fourth. We prayed for the 46 million babies that were aborted this year in the world. It was the fourth one. And I reminded the people, I said, look, we pray for the things in Southeast Asia, Darfur, and Virginia massacre, but there are more babies aborted in approximately one day in this world last year than everyone who's died in Darfur through the genocide. Just remember to put everything in perspective. One out of four pregnancies in this world end in abortion. And I just wanted to remind them. And I find it that I do not retreat from these issues. And you have to remember, as evangelicals, young, growing evangelicals that were influential in your churches, not simply to look at the issues of the moment, which you have to look at the issues of the moment, without remembering some of the graver issues that still exist in the past. So I would say that, it's a matter of time. We take stands, our church does take stands, in terms of homosexuality and abortion, and we are not afraid to. But we are well known amongst the people at our church and growing amongst people in San Francisco of the compassion we do. I feel that the more bolder you are to take a moral platform, the greater it needs to actually live out a life of grace. I'll give you one story. I was asked to join a Interfaith Council, which is the most liberal group in San Francisco you ever want to meet. I was listening to them, and they had this person says, I finally can say that I'm a Christian, even though I don't believe in the myths of Christ. And I said, that's a kind of interesting thing. You don't believe in the resurrection, but you could say it's like the bizarrest combination ever, right? So I tell this guy, his name is Jim. I said, another guy. I asked, why'd you invite me? Why'd you invite me to this place? He says, I'm a theologian. He says, yeah, but you guys do more for San Francisco as a church than all these other guys combined. I said, okay. It's weird. There was an unusual article in Asian Week. The writer put this foot in his mouth by saying, why hate black people? And it caused a big stir in San Francisco because we of our equality, we're a quality city. So who do they ask when they have a platform of the rainbow of spiritual leaders in the city of San Francisco? They call me, you know. You know, I got strong views. You know, I was also the same one who condemned Gavin Newsom, you know. And now I'm supporting, you know, equality, and I'm fighting bigotry too, you know. I have no problem. I'm in the paper and everything quoting me. And it's the way you do all things. And sometimes they don't like what you do, you still do it. Sometimes they love what you do, you still do it. You know, when I was at, and then I'll give one final thing. I always get cut out the newspaper clippings of the things after I've done it in the city realm. When I met Gavin Newsom, I spoke to him with four pastors. We represented like 200. The newspaper article read, "Hundreds of fundamentalists, past preachers, rain hell, fire and brimstone on mayor." And I was looking. I said, "I don't think I did that." And then when I did the one on bigotry, well, they love that one. You know, I'm with the Islamic imam, you know, and, you know, my quotes are really nice. And, you know, they love that one. But I don't let that bother me. I still hold what I hold and, you know, defend, you know, justice and defend, you know, what I think is morality. Yes, final question.
You touched on this earlier.
Yes.
About moving your ethnic church from being an isolated,
yes,
Wow,
the process. Okay, the question is, what is the process of moving an isolationist ethnic community into one that is more socially involved? I'll tell you this. I once heard a speaker that says, if you ever want to change something in church, one, the senior pastor has to be involved. You can't have like some assistant guy relegated it to it and says, I'm not really interested, you do it. Okay, senior pastor, because the people tend, if they don't listen to the senior pastor, they don't listen to anybody. So it's got to be him. And the senior pastor has to not only bleed it, he has to hemorrhage it on the pulpit. They have to see his passion. You cut me. I bleed the word of God. I bleed prayer. And I bleed... showing of grace to people. I bleed that. I proclaim it. Use the pulpit. The pulpit is the strongest thing you can do. And you use it the way that Paul used to write letters to the epistles. It wasn't like one letter fit all. He honed in on what each community of believers needed. And you use the pulpit to preach it until they get it. I might lose my job, but I'm going to preach it until they get it. If I lose my job first, then let it be. If they get it first, that's okay. But I'm going to, and what we do is we always have opportunities to do the community. You see, a lot of them will say, oh, yeah, I feel like I need to do something, and they don't have anything to do. Well, we always have, Bill's an elder in my church, we always have the opportunities every Sunday. And I tell people, I said, it's not that you do everything. It's that at the end of your life, if you say to God, well, I didn't have opportunity to do anything, they'd say, well, didn't Pastor Jeff give you one every Sunday that you worshiped and you didn't do anything? And it takes away that excuse. And so I also give a variety of opportunities. Like, not everyone can do everything. You want to avoid the specialist opportunities. Oh, we're looking for our graduates from MIT with PhDs to help some, you know, come on, how many of those? Oh, we're looking for computer illiterate people. We're looking for accountants to help poor people with their taxes. Well, by the nature of that work, it's limiting. Now, if you have very broad, we're looking for people to help rebuild something. Well, then maybe the men can do it. We're looking for tutors. We're looking for people to man the station to collect gifts for the needy. You put it really low. Because if you just have ministries for the specialist, by the nature of what you present, you will not get total involvement. And not everything you do will be successful. You have to understand who your congregation is and what kind of people they're in. Like, we were exploring prison ministry. The thing is, we love prison ministry, but Chinese, we're not really good with prisoners, you know? They look at us, we don't have street cred, you know? So, understand that. I don't have street cred. So why am I forcing it like it's some like little badge of courage that I could do prison ministry, man? No, man, it's not what I am. They don't know, they won't look at it. So don't do that. What can you do? And that's very, very important. Don't feel like, oh, you got to do these five things or you're nothing. It's very flexible. Put it at the lowest level, very, very broad. Okay, we got to end here. Thank you. It was a joy. Take care. God's blessing.